Thanks, Phil. Good morning, everybody. How are we doing? A few murmurs of vague contentment. Let me pray before we talk about another big topic. Father God, thank you that you're with us. Thank you that what you have to say is good, it's for our good. And I pray this morning you would help us to engage with what you have to say, not with what I say so much. And I pray anything I say that's not helpful would just be deleted from people's brains, and that what you have to say would stick. Amen. So this is diving straight in. We're quite early in the service, aren't we, to dive straight into a talk. This is week three of our little series on relationships and identity. Week one was about sex generally, how God invented it, what it's for. We touched on how our culture has very powerful ideas about sex, which in practice don't always work for healthy relationships. Week two last week was on homosexuality, what God says, how we might respond. Today we're talking about the hot topic of gender identity and how on earth we understand this, if we even can. I've got to say, by the way, this is the last time I'll talk for a longer time. I'm going to talk for longer this morning. Next week's still part of the series, but I won't be as long. You'll be delighted to hear. So if you've been here every week, well done. We're in the home stretch of the mega long sermons. If you're visiting today and you're not a follower of Jesus, I'm sorry, you are visiting on an intense week. We don't talk about this sort of thing all the time, but we do think that sometimes we should hit the big issues of the day. And knowing this is a big issue, I'd ask that you hear everything that I have to say before making judgments, because God is good news for everybody on the planet, even if in our limited field of vision and understanding that sometimes is hard to see. Now, it's clear that the debate and the profile around gender and identity has become enormous in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. I mentioned last week, when I started university in 2000, there was an LGB society on campus, but you didn't really ever hear any mention of the word transgender. The T got added more recently, and then more letters, of course, have followed. And where this is different from the issue of same-sex relationships is this. Those who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual are talking primarily about the sort of person they are attracted to and what relationship they may have. Gender identity is more about who or what you say you are. It might have some connection with sexual expression, but it is a slightly different thing, and it touches many areas of life. The Gender Identity Development Service for children in this country and adolescents up to the age of 18 years has seen referrals rise by more than 50% every year since 2012. So 50% more every single year. Clearly, this is an issue that is on the rise. Not very long ago, all of the conversation around this would have seemed completely unreal. Many people, Christians or otherwise, are figuring out what does all this mean and how do we respond? It's such a huge thing. But today I want to share 6 thoughts that I hope will help followers of Jesus to engage with this well. First one is how we got here. How did we get to the point where there's all this debate around gender? Well, a little bit of history, and I won't be very long, honestly. For over 1,000 years in the West, the Bible had a big dominant influence on Western culture. It opens with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Many people believe that God created the world with a purpose which gave it order and meaning. And from there, to live a life of meaning and purpose meant to live in a way that was lined up with our Creator. Then in the 1600s, the philosopher René Descartes changed everything when he wrote, "I think, therefore I am." You may have heard that phrase, quite famous, "I think, therefore I am." And Descartes was looking for a fixed point of certainty from which to reason things. And he did personally believe in God, but his approach changed everything. The reference point for understanding the world was no longer God, the Creator, but it was me and my reason. The anchor moved from God to us and our thoughts. And from here, philosophers tried to figure out everything from reason. Baruch Spinoza said, "The highest activity a human being can attain is learning for understanding, because to understand is to be free." If only we could figure everything out, he thought. We could make sense of everything. We could fix the problems of the world. You know, we don't need a God to rescue us. You know, we can rescue ourselves with our good thinking. from that point, it all got very rational and dry for a while, and the scientists loved it, but all the artists and the poets didn't. If we somehow lost the richness of life in all our thinking, what was the answer? So next came Romanticism, which suggested, well, life is really, it's all about the spontaneous overflow of feelings. That's what it's about. And the Romantics said, well, you know, science will teach us a lot of things, but really life is about what wells up inside us. It's feelings that give us colour and meaning. Then as science explained more and more, Friedrich Nietzsche famously claimed that we didn't need God anymore. But he also realised that to lose God was to lose the thing that was giving life meaning. He was one of the boldest in claiming that life was ultimately meaningless. When you look into an abyss, the abyss looks into you, he said. And then came Jean-Paul Sartre. Oop, we've clicked ahead there. Please fix it, Fiona. Thank you. Jean-Paul Sartre, who agreed with Nietzsche that life was ultimately meaningless, but saw that we couldn't live without meaning. We would need to get it from somewhere else. And he said that God does not exist, I can't deny, that my whole being cries out for God, I cannot forget. He created a crisis. But he suggested that we could create our own meaning by our choices. We are our choices, he claimed. Jacques Derrida built on this, saying that although there's no absolute meaning in the world, we can create our own meaning and identity through what we do, through what we identify with and what we present to the world. And that starts sounding very familiar because that's broadly what people say now. I create my identity, I create meaning, I create reality. So then we create our own meaning and we live it in the world around us. Life becomes what I interpret it to be and how I present myself to the world. Now, I've just rattled through several hundred years of philosophy, but let's summarize. We started with the Creator God giving meaning and purpose and hope to life. Descartes moved the reference point from God to our reason. Spinoza said, well, let's try and figure out everything with reason. The Romantics said, oh, no, hold on, it's feelings and experiences that are what matters. And then Nietzsche said, oh, no, life is meaningless without God. And then Sartre and Derrida explored how to create meaning and identity for ourselves through our choices. Add all this up, and you have the perfectly created climate for how our society works or doesn't work now. Everybody has their own truth, their own custom-made identity that they just choose to present to the world. And people believe this so strongly, it's assumed. You can't often ask questions around any of this. It's just assumed this is how we live. And in recent years, this focus on the self as the fountain of meaning has spilled into how we see sexuality and relationships and even what it is to be human. And then for today, even around what gender is and what that means. Now, to cover all the language that has developed on this would be a huge task. But briefly, just for our purposes today, we need to make one particular distinction. Transgender is about when someone's core sense of who they are as a person does not sit comfortably with the body they are in. And that can be on a range from some discomfort and uncertainty right through to the strong feeling of being imprisoned in the wrong body. Now, we need to distinguish this from intersex, which is where somebody is born with sexual organs, like literal sexual organs, that are ambiguous. And the difference is, intersex is a physical condition that requires some interpretation, while transgender is a much broader identity issue. For some people, they experience a tension between their biological sex and their sense of identity, sometimes at an early age, and understandably, in that confusion, can experience a great deal of distress. And that distress is what has been called gender dysphoria. Professional diagnosis of gender dysphoria is relatively rare, something like 1 in 13,000 born male and 1 in 34,000 born female. Transgender is now the umbrella term that is used for all the various ways in which people might describe themselves when they don't feel they can be understood in the simple categories of male and female. And then it gets very confusing. Once male and female are not the categories, there's not really any reason to limit how you identify yourself. According to an article on MedicineNet last year, there are now 73 regularly used gender terms, each with its own nuances and perspective as a way of describing the feelings and experiences of whoever uses it. I'm not going to list all 73 now. You wouldn't remember them all, and there'll probably be more by the time we finished. But following the logic behind this, there could be as many gender identities in the world as there are people, because every individual person could have one. But the key idea behind it is that who we are is our choice, regardless of the body that we find ourselves in. But can you see how this has been completely produced by the philosophy of the last few hundred years? I identify as has become the final authority in understanding human nature. And so all the debate around this does not happen in a vacuum. It's all within a set of assumptions about truth and reason that are widely held but rarely mentioned or questioned. But second thing, this is not theoretical. It affects real people. It's very personal and emotional. When you believe your core identity as a person to be a certain thing, it's very hard that anyone might poke and prod what that may be or question or debate the whole thing. But there are stats around the experience of trans people that are very, very hard reading. Children in care or who have been adopted are far more likely to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria. 56% of those identifying as trans have experienced at least 4 incidents of abuse or trauma in their life. While there's not enough evidence to say there's a direct correlation, we can say there is a significant overlap at least. The majority of trans-identifying people have experienced very difficult things, and we should be extremely sensitive and sympathetic around that. Tragically, over 40% of young people who identify as trans have attempted suicide at some point. And also, 10 to 15 years after surgical reassignment, when someone goes as far as having surgery, the suicide rate of those who'd undergone sex reassignment surgery is 20 times that of comparable peers. This is really hard stuff, terrible stuff that's going on in our society. A couple of facts. In December, the Cambridge Dictionary announced that it had changed the definition of the words woman and man to include anyone who identifies as such. And in 2021, the High Court ruled that under 16s would be able to have transition treatments with parental consent and did not specify the youngest age that this could happen. That means it's possible in this country, with no minimum age, if your parents agree, to be diagnosed and treated with puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, with little research into the long-term effects on health or fertility, or even to have sexual organs removed or modified. Where less than 20 years ago, someone with gender dysphoria would have been treated for mental health issues, we've switched around completely, and we now try to treat the body under the assumption that the brain and the person's feelings are what should be followed medically. In other words, rather than making the brain line up with the biology, we now try to make the biology line up with the brain. At some point in recent years, that shift was made without much debate. And the emotions around this are extremely strong. Even raising questions is often frowned upon. As Nancy Piercy, the researcher, writes, "Why is it considered acceptable to carve up a person's body to match their inner sense of self, but bigoted to help them change their sense of self to match their body? Feelings can change, but the body is an observable fact that does not change. It makes sense to treat it as a reliable mark of gender identity." But of course, this is about real people. One story I read, a lady called Chloe Cole, who was 12 when she began to experience gender dysphoria. And even now, she's only 18, and she writes this. "Like many dysphoric children, I also suffer from a variety of mental health conditions. So I easily fell prey to the narrative that if I felt different and did not want to be a highly sexualized girl, I must be a boy. I believed that all my insecurities and anxieties would magically disappear once I transitioned. The mental health professionals did not try to dissuade me. I was placed on puberty blockers, testosterone, and approved for a double mastectomy all by the age of 15. Nobody explored why I did not want to be a girl." She later says, "Who really believes that as a 15-year-old girl, I should have my healthy breasts removed or that should even have been an option?" This, of course, is not something that only affects trans-identifying people, though. The LGBTQIA movement, although very influential, is not one voice, as is sometimes assumed. For example, many who identify as lesbians are terrified of what trans rights means for them, as are many feminists. You may be aware there's been a number of high-profile people who have commented on this issue, and whichever side they're on, immediately face an awful lot of criticism. The nub of the debate, which is in the news right now, is this. If biological men can identify as women and occupy spaces that are for women, then where can biological women be safe? Women who have had bad experiences of men, which sadly I think is most women, reasonably want to know that society is ordered in a way that protects them. Mary Lou Singleton, who is from the Women's Liberation Front, says this, "My entire life's work is fighting for the class of people who are oppressed on the basis of their biological sex, including things like forced marriage, infanticide of baby girls, and FGM, which occur across the globe. But because of the gender identity movement, it's now deemed transphobic to even label these victims as women and girls. As soon as there is no such thing as women beyond what the individual says, there is no way to protect biological women." As Nancy Piercy again writes, "To protect women's rights, we must be able to say what a woman is. If the body is just a social construct, then it becomes impossible to argue for rights on the sheer fact of being female. We cannot legally protect a category of people if we cannot identify that category." So you can see, whilst our culture has a big emphasis on the individual and how the individual feels and their own perception, it turns out how we see ourselves and how we identify ourselves does not just affect, you know, you or I, the individual. It affects our families, it affects our communities, it affects society as a whole. And to say otherwise is naive at best. And this is the great tension that many people feel right now, and you may be one of them. Many of us want transgender people to be supported, cared for, loved, accepted. And those desires come from a really good place. We see the worth of the individual. But when that clashes with the concerns of others, or when it seems like it could be detrimental to that individual, it's very hard to know how it all fits together. We're talking about real human suffering, deeply hurting vulnerable people, and this can be life and death. But without God to guide us, there's no anchor, there's no yardstick, there's nothing but opinion and preference and ultimately chaos and isolation. What has gone wrong is surely the not that anybody has somehow accidentally ended up in the wrong body, but that we've listened to the wrong voices, to ourselves and the popular voices around us, rather than God. And this means that society right now has no cohesive view of personhood or of the body. And as long as we do that, there will always be tension in discussion and suffering individuals, and medicine and law and even sports and other things will always be difficult. What hope is there? We need to start wrestling with that. Briefly, third thought. Remember, everyone has identity struggles. Everyone. And this should give us some perspective and humility. Everyone struggles with their identity sometime in some way. Let me give some examples. If you're newly retired, or an empty nester, or you didn't get the promotion you wanted at work, or you live with a disability, or you simply don't like how you look, or you had an absent parent growing up, and many other things, it's likely you will struggle with your identity at some point. In fact, you may have done your whole life. And so before any of us sort of starts thinking or talking like, you know, those trans people over there or anything like that, let's remember all of us are broken. All of us have insecurities. All of us need help and comfort. There is no space here for pride or condemning others. We're all human. We all need to find our identity in the one place it cannot be contested or changed. Which leads to point four. And don't worry, we're starting to get a little bit more positive now. God gives us our true nature, and he's great news. The million-dollar question is, what does God, if anything, say about this? Well, we're unlikely to find a Bible passage that deliberately addresses the modern ideas of gender identity. But the Bible does tell a story that helps us interpret everything that we think about what it is to be human. God made men and women, and he did so on purpose. Genesis 1, which we've looked at a few times in this series, is foundational to this. It says, "Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so they may rule over fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. The language here is very simple, let's face it. But don't miss that this is amazing. This is very different from every single other ancient and probably modern creation idea. The other ancient creation stories all say that humans are here by mistake, or they're here to serve the gods, of which there were many. Genesis says, no, there's one God. He made us in his image. We bear his likeness. And it's only on that basis that we can say anything solid about human worth and dignity. He made us. He gives us meaning and identity and purpose. And it's wonderful. As the former chief rabbi of the UK, Jonathan Sacks, points out, in the ancient world, it was rulers, emperors, and pharaohs who were held to be in the image of God. And so what Genesis was saying was that we're all royalty. Isn't that incredible? What a basis for the rest of what we're going to talk about. Just after this, in Genesis 2, when it talks about God creating Adam and Eve, our translations tend to say that God made Eve out of Adam's rib, but in the Hebrew, it's actually a word, tselah, which means the side of a sacred piece of architecture, like, for example, the Jewish temple. In other words, it was saying Adam and Eve are both sacred, they're both special to God. And modern philosophy tends to say, well, you have a body, you know, you're basically, you're some meat around a skeleton, but the real you is your brain and your feelings. But God says you don't have a body, you are a body. It's inextricably you. But then in particular, and this is where it becomes challenging to the topic, it says God made them male and female, biologically two types of human. Now, it says nothing at all about the gender stereotypes that we've developed. It does not say men like sports and fixing cars. And it does not say women like hairdressing and flowers. There's no stereotypes. But men and women simply are different on their deepest levels of being. Our chromosomes are different. Our brains are different. Our voices are different. Our body shapes are different. Our reproductive systems are different. What our bodies are designed and structured to do differ. And these designs reflect God's creative will for us. He's made men and women different but complementary. Men need women and women need men for humanity to work. Take one away and it all goes wrong. Each of us uniquely made. Look at these wonderful words from the poetry of Psalm 139. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in a secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Just look at the intimate knowledge God has of each person, the intention that he put in, the miracle of producing a life that lies in his hands. Taking this, owning this, is the starting point for understanding what it is to be human. We are not accidental. We are not a mistake. We are not left to our own devices to come up with things that give us significance. It's already there. And let me say to everybody in the room, take these words personally, right? Personally, you were made with every strand of hair, every bit of DNA, every freckle, every quirk of your body, and you have eternal significance. No other view of the world's going to tell you that. None of us needs to look inward into our own fragile opinions and ideas or to the words of others because we can look upward and hear these great words of affirmation. That's how God made it. That's how it's supposed to be, knowing and enjoying what he says about us. Fifth thought, Jesus is the one who truly experienced being in the wrong body. The idea of having absolute freedom to create ourselves and define our own meaning and identity can sound very attractive at first, daring, exciting, but it soon becomes an overwhelming burden when we realize we can't create a satisfactory identity and purpose for ourselves. It's a burden we were never meant to carry. We need help. If the world is a mess and the message of the trans movement does not have the answers, just like nobody else does, where do we go? not just for philosophical answers, but for help on a personal level. For the person who struggles with understanding their identity and cries tears of isolation, where is there to go? Incredibly, we have a God who's experienced all the battles that we do, and he's the place to go. In the New Testament letter 2 Corinthians, chapter 5 is a passage all about the frustrations of the body in this life. And it talks about how Jesus reconciles us to God in a relationship. But right at the end, it has this one amazing sentence. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Our bodies are broken. None of us are perfect. Some of us feel that more than others due to our experiences or our age or whatever. But Jesus is God, and he stepped into our world, and he literally took our mess into his own physical body. He was afflicted. The ultimate body dysphoria ever experienced was when he who had no sin was made sin for us. The narrative around his crucifixion tells us how he was flogged and hit and given a crown of thorns and nailed to a cross and had a spear stuck in his side. That is really being in the wrong body, so to speak. He who was perfect, taking on all imperfection. He experienced the ultimate brokenness so that we would never have to. And so hear this. In Jesus, God knows our experiences and we're not alone. And in Jesus, we will never experience the ultimate dysphoria or the ultimate isolation or the ultimate pain because he already has. Which leads to the sixth point. Let's find our identity in Jesus. If the good news is that Jesus has dealt with mess and misery and sin and death, what does it mean for now? What does it mean, let's say, for a teenager who is biologically male but feels deeply uncomfortable and is drawn to identify as female? What does it mean for any of us when it comes to the body? A few thoughts on this. Jesus shows us a different story. The story that says that your identity is found in your sexuality or self-created gender is an entirely modern invention. But the way that God made us was good. We Christians like to say that we get our identity from Jesus rather than anywhere else. But what does that actually mean? Well, think about it like this. The message of the transgender movement, in essence, is something like this. Your identity is first your feelings and second your biology. In other words, how you feel is the controlling guide to your identity. The message of more traditionally minded people is something more like this. Your identity is first your biology and then the second is your feelings. In other words, your feelings don't decide what's true, your biology does. Many people, many Christians would have sympathy with this. But in isolation, this can feel cold and unhelpful to somebody who's struggling. I think the message of Jesus is something more like this. In a nutshell, it's your identity is first what God says, and secondly, it's everything else. It's first what God says, secondly, everything else. Our biology and our feelings both tell us something, but on their own, they're not entirely helpful. They can take us in the wrong direction. Neither is big enough to tell us what it is to be human. But what God says gives us the building blocks, uniquely made, male and female, with worth and dignity and deeply loved. But the challenge that comes with that for all of us is, will you bring everything, including sexuality and gender and everything else, under what Jesus says? God gives you an identity, but will you live in light of it? Jesus also means that we have freedom from gender stereotypes. One thing that's had a significant influence in the growth of gender identity struggles in this country is the presence of unhealthy stereotypes. Many of the stories of transgender people involve being drawn to stereotypically opposite gender things. So, for example, a 14-year-old boy says, well, I'm less into power tools and rugby and more into netball and fashion. Now, these are more feminine, so maybe that's the real me. And that leads to a whole number of thoughts and feelings. It's not the only influence in a complex thing, but it is significant. People, especially the young, are shaped by the assumed standards of the surrounding culture. But what's great about God is that his given identity lets us be how we are without affecting who we are. It frees us from stereotypes and cultural expectation. Andrew Bunt, who's a friend of a friend, has written this great book. He's a Christian who, growing up, struggled with gender dysphoria and a few other things. And he says this, I had a set of ideas of what a real man was like, and I didn't fit into the box. I realized that I'm a man because God says I'm a man, not because of some ability to live up to certain expectations. I can live out my identity as a man with the unique personality and preferences God gave me. This means I don't need to worry about not liking sports, hating aggression, and usually finding it easier to develop friendships with women than men. And it means I can embrace my love of musicals, Downton Abbey, and my flamboyant nature, as none of these things change my identity. I can be how I am without changing who I am. And that's the real freedom. Being how we are, with all our quirks and our own ways and so on, without feeling the need to change who we are in God. That's what leads to peace around your identity. Jesus also equips us to love the other. The debate around gender identity has become something of a culture war, like liberals v conservatives or moderns v postmoderns, but it doesn't need to be that way. As God's people, we're called to recognise we are all short of God's ways. We've all failed to love. We all have a love dysphoria, you could say. If you're here today as somebody who identifies as trans, or maybe this is an internal battle for you, maybe nobody knows about it, please forgive the rest of us when we have failed you. If this is not a personal issue for you and you just don't understand the whole thing, God's call is the same as in every other situation. With humility, love the other. Jesus gives us the reason and the resources to do exactly that. Finally, Jesus promises a new creation and a new body. The world is broken, clearly unmistakably broken. Every one of us knows this. Things are not how they should be or could be. Because of sin, because of our selfishness as a species, everything is off what it could be. We all sense it. Even those who don't identify as Christians sense this. But Jesus promises that one day everything will be made right. His resurrection will be the first fruits, the promise of what will happen. In Philippians 3, written by a man who was in prison, he says, our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a saviour from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control will transform our lowly bodies so they will be like his glorious body. One day, heaven and earth will be the same place. Everything will be how we know intuitively it should be. We will be made into what we were always intended to be, given new bodies that are still us, meaning that anything that has gone wrong with the body in this life, whether done to us or done by somebody else or by accident, it's not forever. Whatever you have done, whatever will happen to you, in Jesus, it does turn out okay in the end. No dysphoria, no isolation, no disability, no identity struggles, none of it. There's hope for all of us, but there's only one place you can find it, in the person whose body was broken for all of us. So just to summarise what we've said today, which I was relying on being on the screen because I haven't written it down. Thanks, Fiona. The band, you might want to come up because we're going to respond in worship in a second. In summary, our culture's message that we should define ourselves and our identity and our reality is a product of Western philosophy and should be questioned. The emphasis on the self as the sole authority leads to harm and isolation. In our human brokenness, we all have identity struggles outside God. The great news is that God tells us who we really are, and he deliberately and lovingly made us. Jesus experienced the ultimate bodily dysphoria when he took on sin for us. And finally, finding our identity in Jesus frees us from the stories that betray us and the stereotypes that hurt us. With him, there is always hope, and a wonderful future will come in a new creation. I think there's good reason to worship, isn't there? Let's do that. Please stand.